Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hello everyone and welcome back to These Times. I'm Tom McTay.
And I'm Helen Thompson.
This week we're going to talk about a dramatic story that's developing far away from the usual geopolitical hotspots that we spend most of our time talking about on this podcast, but one we think is incredibly important nonetheless. And that's the story of Guyana and Venezuela, who are currently locked in a territorial dispute that the UN felt it had to intervene in last week to send a warning flare expressing its concern about the growing tensions there. Now, Guyana is the fastest growing economy in the world, fueled by the discovery of oil in 2015, and now finds itself threatened by invasion from Venezuela. Venezuela, meanwhile, now finds itself under fresh sanctions by the United States issued only last week. Now, this dispute might appear parochial to Latin America, but far from it. This is a conflict that has ramifications far beyond South America and the Caribbean, affecting the United States, China, Iran, and even Europe.
So the question we're going to ask in this week's episode is why is what is happening in Guyana and Venezuela having such geopolitical repercussions for the rest of the world?
Venezuela has voted overwhelmingly in favor of claiming a disputed oil-rich territory long controlled by neighboring Guyana.
The U.S. says it'll conduct joint military flight drills within Guyana as tensions rise with neighboring Venezuela.
Venezuela argues that Essequibo was part of it under Spanish colonial rule, but the territory was also claimed by the British who ruled Guyana.
Guyana's president responded by placing the country's limited military resources on high alert.
We will not allow our territory to be violated, nor the development of our country to be stymied by this desperate threat.
So we have Guyana and Venezuela, two countries on the northern tip of South America. Now, we're going to spend the first half of this episode talking mostly about Guyana and the second half talking about Venezuela. So Guyana. Guyana is a small English-speaking state that is culturally part of the Caribbean, actually, but sits on the South American mainland bordering Venezuela. It was a British colony originally, but is now an independent republic within the Commonwealth still. Now, it was actually a relatively poor country of about 800,000 people, which few people outside the region really paid much attention to. But then in 2015, ExxonMobil discovered oil, and that changed the story completely. Now, Helen, you're obviously the expert on this. Why are oil discoveries, these oil discoveries in particular, so important?
I think there's lots of different ways of thinking about this, Tom. The first of them is to say that in the big scheme of things, in a way, the volume of oil that Guyana is producing is not particularly significant. It's less than a million barrels per day.
Right.
That means that not only is it not like top-tier producer, obviously, like Saudi Arabia, Russia, the United States, nor is it a mid-tier producer in the 4 to 5 million barrels of oil a day like Canada or even China. It's not even in the low range of 2 million plus, which would take, say, Kuwait.
Right.
there is hope that it's going to get to about 1.5 million, maybe 1.7 million by 2027. That's what ExxonMobil are projecting. So why, you might ask, is a country that's producing a relatively small amount of oil having such significance in oil markets? Mm-hmm. We can understand, and we're going to come to this, why the volume of oil that's being pumped is a very big deal for Guyana itself. Mm-hmm. But why is Guyana in some ways the story of oil markets? And to understand that, I think we have to see several different things. The first of them is that when that oil was discovered in 2015 offshore in Guyana, these were probably the best discoveries in the 21st century.
Wow.
Certainly among the very best in the 21st century. If you look at the world's largest oil fields, the 20 largest oil fields in the world, they're old, they're right. aging. Most of them have been discovered before the late 1960s. One of the reasons why the world economy required the shale oil boom in the 2010s is precisely because what gets called conventional oil, that's oil produced by conventional drilling techniques, the production of that or output had stagnated around 2005. So any new conventional oil is pretty significant. Then we've got the fact that if you look at quality of the oil that's produced in Guyana, it's very good quality oil. It's not cheap because it's offshore.
Right.
So it doesn't compare with low-cost onshore Middle Eastern production in that respect. But it's a lot better quality oil than the oil that comes from shale. And one of the things I think it is important to see, because I think that this is where the narrative that the US became oil independent or energy independent in shale is wrong, is the United States still imports a considerable amount of oil, something like, I think, about 8 million in gross terms, 8 million barrels per day.
Wow.
Its net imports have come down dramatically, but its gross imports haven't. And one of the reasons is because what comes from shale is not of sufficient quality, particularly what gets called tight oil, to be able to be used for diesel.
Right.
The great thing about Guyana's oil is that it's of comparable quality to the crude that's been produced, say, in Saudi Arabia. And if you look at the exploratory wells that were done by ExxonMobil, most of them were successful, and that's very, very unusual.
Right. Well, like the hit rate is successful.
The hit rate is really extraordinarily high in some respects. So that gives the hope that actually this is the beginning of the story rather than the end of the story.
Right. I mean, I was speaking to Trevor Phillips, the British broadcaster, who spent a lot of his childhood in Guyana. And he was saying that there is some hope that there is potentially 30 to 40 billion barrels of oil in Guyana, which is a lot. I mean, that sounds a lot. I suppose my stupid question then is, I thought we were supposed to be weaning ourselves off oil and diesel. So why is it so important? As you say, it's a small amount in the grand scheme of things. We're supposed to be moving into a new world. Why do we care?
I think the answer to that is twofold. The first of them is that the world economy is still using, probably last year it was 103 million barrels per day.
Right.
That compares, if you want a point of comparison, to around 90 million in 2010. So that's basically still adding a million a year.
Yeah.
A million a day a year. I mean, it's more complicated than that because there's the crash in the demand for oil in 2020 because of the pandemic.
That's still a considerable growth, even in percentage terms, from 90 to over 100. So you're talking about a 10% growth in that period.
Absolutely. And what we can see is that whilst there are certain countries, mainly Western countries, where oil consumption is coming down, it's still growing quite significantly in emerging market countries, and particularly the large population Asian countries. And even if you take a country like China, where there has been considerable success on the electric vehicles front in terms of sales of electric vehicles, that doesn't necessarily mean that oil demand comes down. Indeed, quite the contrary, because what you can see in China is that demand for oil, not to use it as an energy source, but to use it essentially as an industrial feedstock, what gets called petrochemicals,
right,
is going up. And petrochemicals are actually quite important in doing things like building electric vehicles.
Right. So you need oil to build electric vehicles. Right. Okay. And then you also need something to produce the energy that drives, that creates the electricity as well. And that presumably China's nowhere near.
China doesn't use oil for electricity purposes. But I think that what we can say reasonably confidently is that for the moment anyway, that the energy transition is not really in any systematic way driving oil demand at a global level downwards. Now, the International Energy Agency is projecting that maybe in terms of the actual energy demand for oil, that it will have peaked before this decade is over, but you would still see a significant increase in the overall demand for oil because of petrochemicals. The other reason why what happens even at the relative margins, and obviously less than 1 million barrels a day is the relative margins in this respect, is that it isn't the case that all the oil producing countries of the world are able to export oil into global markets at the moment.
Yeah.
So there's sanctions. The sanctions formerly on Iran, and now, as you said in the beginning, back on Venezuela. Now, Venezuela, for reasons that we'll come to in the second half, has been producing very little or relatively little oil for quite a long time now. But Iran could clearly produce more if it weren't under sanctions, even though it's also engaging in quite effective sanction busting. But there's another place as well where oil exports are constrained, and that's the semi-autonomous Kurdistan in northern Iraq, because the Iraqi government in Baghdad has basically embargoed the export of oil from Kurdistan as part of its pressure on Kurdistan. So once you're in a situation where oil prices are in, which they still are, in the sort of $85 to $90 a barrel range, then what happens with these relatively small producers is of some significance.
So I guess the sort of geopolitical question for me then, or the obvious one, is apart from the fact that the people of Guyana are about to get incredibly rich and sort of, you know, good for them, there's 800,000 of them and there's a lot of oil for the size of the country, and it will have an impact on the margins of global oil prices, which affect us all. You know, why is this then an important geopolitical story? Like, I suppose this is a part of the world which traditionally, at least, would be America's backyard. You know, they are, and it's an American company that has discovered this oil. So you can clearly see the relationships developing there. Why is it getting other countries involved? Why is it sort of bringing the world's attention onto Guyana so obviously?
Well, I think there are two things here. One of them is we need to get to, as you said, the basically territorial claim that Venezuela is making on Guyana. I think the first of them goes back to the fact that the growth in the oil production over the last decade or so has primarily taken place in the Western Hemisphere. So the US shale boom, Canadian tar sands, Brazil, which is producing in the sort of between 3 and 4 million barrels a day, and now Guyana. Now that's quite significant if you think of the Middle East and Russia as the other centerpieces, if you like, of world oil production. Why Guyana, though, is particularly significant, you could say, is first because it's Western oil companies doing this on terms that are actually pretty unfavourable to Guyana, which is in itself an issue in politics. Guyana's not in a good position to negotiate with ExxonMobil in this respect. But I think it's also because Brazil, which is the other non-North American in the quartet of Western Hemisphere significant producers over the last decade, formally, at least, in January of this year, joined OPEC Plus.
And that's the oil-producing states with Russia, Saudi Arabia. Right.
Which Venezuela is also part of. So you can see it in that sense as Guyana as being a Western-friendly place in the geopolitics of oil in a way which might be coming open to question about Brazil.
Right, okay. And so then Guyana is something that that you want to keep as part of a Western-friendly alliance. Obviously, Venezuela long since lost, Brazil on the edge. And then we get to then the territorial dispute that I guess is the center of this story alongside oil. This is a territorial dispute that goes back a long way, but it's really quite dramatic when you look at it on a map. What Venezuela is asking for is effectively like 2/3 of the country of Guyana. It's not like a marginal change that it's seeking. It wants 2/3 of the country, much of which contains the offshore oil, I mean, oil reserves. So the oil is playing into an old dispute. And the dispute is complicated, but again, it reveals a lot about the changing political dynamics in the world, I think. It goes back to, an original source of wealth. Gold was discovered in this area. And then there was a dispute between the various imperial powers, Spain, Britain, the Netherlands, ends up with Britain in control of this land. And that was seen to be the story until Venezuela started, now newly independent, started lobbying the United States to intervene and to say, hang on, you have declared this thing called the Monroe Doctrine, which says that the United States is in control of the Americas and no European powers should have any control. And yet you're allowing this old country, this old European power, to dominate, and it has stolen our land. Now, that is the sort of the basis of the argument simplified. And interestingly, the American government then gets involved and sides with the Venezuelans based on this Monroe Doctrine.
Yeah. I think we should need to just like backtrack like one little bit there, Tom. So that the dispute in terms of where the territory, which is essentially between the Orinoco River and the Essequibo River, and that's why it's called the Essequibo like territory. So it's the territory east of the Essequibo that Venezuela is claiming. The reason why that's a dispute for Venezuela is, as you've sort of suggested, because it was a dispute between the British and the Spanish when the British basically took control of that colony during the Napoleonic Wars. I think it's in 1814. And that's an agreement really between the British and the Dutch, because it had been a Dutch colony previously.
Which is why you got Suriname next door, yeah, which is Dutch.
Absolutely. And then the Spanish are preoccupied with events in Europe. So the British themselves then, particularly after the discovery of gold, want a border shifted into Venezuela, which is by this point independent from Spain. And they do because, as you said, gold is involved. So I think the gold is discovered like in the 1840s or in the...
They do so because they can.
Yeah, and they do so because they can and because the gold's there. Now, already by that point, an American president had declared the Monroe Doctrine. So that was the idea that no European power could act in the Western Hemisphere. That was in 1823. But the reaction of the Europeans to that, particularly the British, is just really to laugh at it.
Right.
An American president is able to say that because this is kind of the Spanish Empire is coming to an end, the independence of the South American states, a notable exception being Cuba. But so far as the British are on side with the Monroe Doctrine, it's so that British can keep exercising their own naval power in around South America. In terms of actually them staying out, they've got no interest in that. What changes is in the 1890s when, after 20 years of basically the Venezuelans saying to the Americans, what are you going to do about the fact that Britain is determining this border and taking our territory away from us for the gold, that American President Cleveland accepts the argument that the Venezuelans are making and says to the British, look, you are going to have to submit to an international tribunal to determine who this territory belongs to. And Lord Salisbury is British Prime Minister at the time, and he's incredibly dismissive about it initially, but he then, which is quite revealing of the shift in power that's taking place, has to accept this tribunal meeting in Paris. Now, the tribunal meets, I think it's in 1895, and takes the British side without presenting any arguments as to why. And the officials are, I think it's two British officials, two Americans, and a Russian meeting in Paris. So you can imagine how that goes down in Caracas.
Yeah.
But I think it is a really crucial watershed moment, though, in terms of the balance of power in the world.
Yeah.
Because from having just been a piece of rhetoric in the 1820s, in a way trying to assert American power after the exit, the general exit of the Spanish, or the weakening, at least, of substantial weakening of Spanish power. Now the Americans are saying, we can actually be the power in the Western Hemisphere, and we are going to set the rules. And even though they effectively sided, all those representatives sided with the British in the verdict, and Venezuela had to accept that America, the United States, wasn't going to continue backing Venezuela over the issue, I think if we look at it in terms of a big geopolitical picture, and the Monroe Doctrine is now part of the of world geopolitics, if you like, and that the Americans had successfully asserted that there was a division between the new world and the old world.
Well, I mean, how much it still holds, I suppose, is open to question, and we can maybe probe that in the second half. I find it so revealing of just international relations in general, I guess, because you've got this almost claim of legality here, that we go to a tribunal and it will be sorted legally and fairly. But it's a tribunal of two Brits, two Americans, and a Russian. And the story that seemed that the Venezuelans seem to believe is effectively the Brits bought off the Russian and left the Americans with no choice but to come up with a kind of compromise that would solve this. But as you say, I think what's really interesting is that it reveals power, and power is the thing that matters. Britain could push a border one way or the other because it had the power to do so. But by the time it gets to the late 19th century, it no longer has the power to act so independently, and the United States is able to assert its power. And then over the course of the 20th century, that power would shift dramatically from Europe to Washington. And that's the basis of where we are today. But what the Venezuelans are doing is they're sort of relitigating this claim and saying that it wasn't fair to begin with. And it seems that from my conversations with Trevor, that what the Venezuelans often do, it is a little bit like the sort of the Falkland Island issue in Argentina. It's something that can bring the country together. There is a general acceptance in Venezuela that this is unfair, and that you can sort of chest beat now and again, and that you will be able to win popularity. But the difference here, because this has happened a number of times over the course of the last few decades, is that oil has been discovered. Mm-hmm. So it matters now. It matters enormously, and it matters beyond Guyana. So you had in December only last year, you had a referendum in Venezuela about this issue, which was, you know, as you can imagine, won overwhelmingly to declare this part of Guyana to be Venezuelan. But it was also became really quite military as well. So you had the Venezuelan military on the border of Guyana, or ready, so it seemed. And if you look at this, you think, well, what can the Guyanans do here? They're the much smaller country. They have very small military capacity. They could not resist a Venezuelan assault if it ever came to just a direct conflict. But then that's when the geopolitics come into this. So if you look at a map, you can see that it's very difficult for Venezuela to actually invade Guyana. They have to go through Brazil, by all accounts. And so you had the Brazilian government moving its military to the north to block the exit. And why are Brazil doing this? Well, in part, there is actually a port that is being built, a deep water port in Guyana, which allows Brazil to export much of its products from the north of Brazil much more easily than taking them all the way down to the ports in the south, Rio de Janeiro, and so on. So you can just already see that a small conflict here is developing out, and it's bringing in Brazil, which is now an oil exporter on its own. And then it's bringing in the United States, not just through the Monroe Doctrine that it's already been involved in for a century or so, but also because it now has an interest in that it's ExxonMobil that is drilling for oil, that has discovered the oil, that has very good terms on its contracts. And as you explained at the beginning, it's now an important part of keeping oil prices down, in part as well because the Americans are sanctioning Venezuela, which has the world's biggest oil reserves. So it all kind of plays in together here.
Yeah, I mean, we're going to get into how Venezuela's oil fits into this story in the second half. But I think you're absolutely right, Tom, to draw out, though, the way in which what is now at issue is both a set of international legal issues, which have got an echo of the past. But obviously, the International Court of Justice that's dealing with the issue now is rather different than that tribunal back in Paris in the 1890s. And it's taking time for the issue to play out there. But the international legal issue and the military issue go hand in hand with each other. Now, I think it's reasonable to say, as for the reasons that you've explained, that militarily, that this is a very difficult option for the Venezuelans. Nonetheless, is that it draws geopolitical focus to this part of the world, in which, for reasons that are to do with Venezuela itself, independently of the Guyana question, are getting increasingly more. And that idea that actually the United States can, as a sort of, whatever we want to call it, quasi-imperial power in relation to South America, determine what goes on in the Western Hemisphere is, I think, over. Wow. And that's where we need to turn in the second half.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Welcome back, everybody. So we finished the first half there with Helen making the point that actually there's something about this crisis which makes you question the American dominance to be able to impose the Monroe Doctrine over South America. Now, that is, it's in some ways quite surprising to me, because I would look at this crisis, I think, and say, in some senses, it seems simple, and surely this can't blow up. You know, you've got American interests in Guyana, and you have an enemy in Venezuela. And there is no way that the Americans could let this crisis run out of control. You know, this has gone to the International Court of Justice at the UN, which has preliminarily ruled in Guyana's favor. You have a referendum in Venezuela that is seeking to reject the legitimacy of the UN. Like, all of this seems to play into a story where you think, look, it's quite, surely it's going to play out quite simply. But I think that's not the case. When you try to analyze this story from a wider perspective. So I think to get at that, we need to explain Venezuela, what's going on there, and then have a look at South America more generally and how China gets involved into this and how this plays into this current situation in Iran. So let's try to run through that story from the start. So Venezuela, I mean, My understanding of Venezuela is it has these oil reserves that it is just kind of squandered. You know, it is the sort of the perfect example of the oil curse, Venezuela. It's terribly poor when it should be terribly rich.
Yeah, and there's a paradox, I think, at the center of the Venezuelan story, which you've hinted at already, Tom, which is that it has the largest known reserves of oil in the world, like by some distance. But in a way, that tells you that reserves of oil don't in themselves mean, you know, a great deal. And Venezuela is scarcely, if at all, producing much more oil than Guyana is at the moment. There are two things, I think, that are particularly important about the Venezuela oil story. The first of them is to do, again, with the oil itself, which is in sharp contrast to the very easy to use and refine oil that Guyana's producing. Venezuelan oil has always been very heavy. It's difficult to refine outside technically specialized refineries. And that need quite considerable technological know-how mm-hmm. in order for that refining to take place. And it's costly.
Right.
So if we then look at like what's happened in the Venezuelan oil industry, Venezuela became a founder member of OPEC back in 1960. Like other members of OPEC, in the 70s, the oil companies were nationalized, a state company was created. That had, though, considerable more autonomy, at least until the latter part of the 90s, than state oil companies usually did in other parts of the world. So it could enter into partnerships with the Western oil companies. But when Chavez came to power in Venezuela in 1998, so he was president of Venezuela between 1998 and his death in 2013, he took control of the oil company effectively and led to considerable exit of technically competent employees from the company. And Venezuela's oil production even then began to fall in relation to its capacity. So that what was needed in terms of the technical expertise to make Venezuelan oil exports work became less and less. So that was already a story in which Venezuela was producing oil at considerably lower level than its capacity. But then something really dramatic happens, and a lot, I think, follows from this, is that in the middle of 2014, the price of oil began to fall. It began to fall from 3 years, I think we mentioned this before, of being above, averaging above anyway, $100 a barrel. And then the Saudis, this is, we certainly have discussed this moment before, decided in November of 2014 that their response to the US shale oil boom was to try to bankrupt the US shale oil mm-hmm. industry with very low prices that the Saudis thought that the American shale companies wouldn't be able to withstand. And the Saudis pushed OPEC, as it still then was, it wasn't OPEC Plus at that point, into increasing oil production on falling prices. And the Venezuelans were just pushed aside mm-hmm. in arguing against that position. They weren't the only ones, but they were the major dissenters. So then when the price of oil crashed, which it did through 2015 into early 2016, the Venezuelans faced a complete economic, and indeed I would say like humanitarian disaster. Mm-hmm. And all the problems with the oil industry combined with this new price shock. Remember that the entire, if you like, Chavez project that President Maduro had continued with after Chavez's death depended on using these oil revenues for social purposes. That was all taken away, because the price of oil was just so incredibly low.
And they are more dependent on high prices because it's so expensive to produce that oil. How much of this story is, you know, to do with the sort of crushing hand of the United States and sanctions and all of that, as well as just sort of managerial incompetence?
Well, I think that it's a two-part story. If you look at the line of Venezuela's oil production through the 2010s, it's flat until 2014. It then just crashes all the way down to it picks up again in 2021, and you start to see an upturn, still to nowhere near where it was. I mean, even in 2011 it was above 2.5 million barrels a day. Now it's still under 1 million barrels of oil a day. There is a crucial moment in 2018, which I think is part of the geopolitics of this moment, which is when Maduro holds this presidential election that international observers deem not to be open, fair, mm-hmm. democratic. And various governments, including the United States, effectively recognize somebody else as leader of Venezuela. And Trump, who is the American president at the time, obviously, he calls maximum pressure, mm-hmm. maximum economic pressure. Note the very same language he's using against Iran after ending the Iran nuclear deal against Venezuela. And that then puts sanctions on Venezuela's oil exports. So now, even as production's falling, they're finding it hard, that it's harder for them to export oil without finding ways to sanction bust. And it's really clear, if you look at the language that John Bolton Trump's national security advisor was using it, it was pretty open and confrontational. Mm-hmm. It was like, we're pursuing regime change in Venezuela, and then when we've succeeded in pursuing regime change in Venezuela, then Western oil companies can go in,
yeah,
particularly American oil companies,
yeah,
can go in and start doing something with these huge reserves that Venezuela had.
But he makes the point, doesn't he, that that would be, in his view, good for America, good for Venezuela. You can suddenly get these reserves out into the system, and that would help in the maximum pressure campaign against Iran, and it would also weaken the American reliance on the Middle East. So it's like a two-pronged benefit potentially for the United States. You can see where he's coming from.
Yeah, if you look at it in the history of the 21st century so far, where American policy towards oil-producing countries is concerned, I think you can put it in a history that includes the Iraq War,
right? You know, yeah,
in 2003, which is to say, we get regime change in Baghdad, Western oil companies can, mm-hmm, go back in. Iraq's another country that significantly underproduced in, mm-hmm, oil in relation to the size of its reserves,
mm-hmm,
and now, as we know,
yeah,
that story, as we've talked about in different ways, didn't exactly turn out the way that the George Bush administration thought that it would. And this story didn't turn out the way in which the Trump administration, in putting those sanctions in place, thought that it would. So even before Trump's left office, I mean, even in 2020, he's looking to try to offer Maduro a deal, to use Trump's own language, effectively saying, if you hold new elections, mm-hmm, then the sanctions can come to an end. But that's not a deal, compromise, whatever you want to call it, that Maduro was willing to take, which meant that when Biden came into office, that the sanctions regime, the quite tough sanction regime, was still in place.
And it's not then just a question of corporate interests. So, you know, obviously ExxonMobil or American or Western oil companies could go into Iraq and make profits there, and the same in Venezuela. It's actually sort of deeper than that. It's about America's ultimate weakness or dependence on other countries in which that it cannot control entirely, OPEC, and their control of the oil price. And that, so America doesn't like to be in that position, understandably, so it wants to weaken that alliance. Is that the kind of basis?
Yeah, remember, though, that by this point, it's not just OPEC, it's OPEC Plus, which includes Russia and a host of other countries, like Kazakhstan, for example. And these stories are not unconnected to each other, because Venezuela, as we said, was the principal casualty of that 2014 oil price crash. And it is hard to, I think, to overstate just what an economic disaster it was for Venezuela. And we'll come to then what the migration effects of that have been. But it didn't work for the Saudis either. And so the reason why OPEC Plus was formed in the autumn of 2016 was the Saudis essentially asking the Russians for help to get the price back up again. So in that move that the Saudis made between over a 2-year period that caused immense problems for Venezuela, we have the origins of the oil cartel now not being simply centered in the Middle East under Saudi leadership as it was before, but effectively under joint Saudi-Russian leadership.
Which is a pretty extraordinary moment, because if you cast in your mind back to that world, you actually have developing relations between the United States and Saudi Arabia, Trump and MBS, and you're the centerpiece of that being what we talked about last week, the attempt to normalize relations between Saudi Arabia and Iran, the Abraham Accords, and yet you're starting to see Saudi Arabia align itself with America's principal strategic rivals, Russia, brought together its relationship with Iran. We talked about this last week again, with China playing the sort of the third man, bringing the two together. So there's this shift in power dynamics playing out everywhere. So, you know, America is not successful in its strategy of maximum pressure, although again, we've talked about this. There are good reasons to think it might have been a sensible policy in relation to Iran, at least, or that there were certainly weaknesses in the Obama approach to Iran. But it's this general sense of actually America is not able to assert its power or control in the way that we might have thought it was able to.
Yeah, and I think if you go to the autumn of 2022, you can see that really clearly. So this is a moment which is, 8 months after Russia's invasion of Ukraine. It's a good 5 months past, actually, the peak of the oil price shock in response to the, or that emerged in the context of Russia's invasion. So the peak of oil prices came around May 2022 at around $120 a barrel. In the summer of 2022, that's when Biden goes to Riyadh and asks Bin Salman, OPEC Plus, to produce some more oil. And he's particularly worried about the upcoming midterm elections. And the response of Bin Salman, I think we've mentioned this moment before, is to say, oh, we'll have some more production cuts, not production increases, which are OPEC Plus announces, I think, in October of 2022. By this point, we've discussed this several times. There's the Iran nuclear deal is going absolutely, or resurrecting the Iran nuclear deal is going absolutely nowhere. So what does the Biden administration do in November 2022? It loosens the sanctions on Venezuela. In particular, it grants Chevron, the American oil company, waivers to resume exporting crude from its joint ventures with the Venezuelan state company. So you can see really how all these different geopolitical events through the course of 2022 are coming together into the Venezuela question. And then you move on another year. And I think it's October this time rather than November, October 2023, there's an agreement whereby Maduro promises that there will be a free and fair, open presidential election. And in return, the sanctions are loosened some more.
Yeah.
The end of that sanction waiver was due to be the end of this month. But it became clear once that Maduro banned effectively the opposition candidate from running, that the Biden administration would have to make a decision as to whether to end the sanctions waiver. And that's what it did last week. You mentioned that right at the beginning of the episode. So, albeit with some get out for Chevron, the sanctions are back on again.
Which then brings you to Guyana and then its importance, which would sort of right to the beginning of the episode. Because if you're struggling with Venezuela, what to do there, do you effectively just accept that it's not a free and fair country and just deal with it anyway to get its oil into the global system? You don't control OPEC Plus at all. I do find it fascinating to even think that it could have been successful going to Riyadh and asking for an increase in oil production when OPEC Plus is Saudi Arabia and Russia. And the cause of the increase in oil prices is the Russia's invasion of Ukraine, paid for in large part by the fact that it has built up such reserves through the export of its oil and gas. It seems kind of ludicrous that then Saudi Arabia would go, okay, I'll help you in that regard. And yet, at the same time, Saudi Arabia is looking for America to be its guarantor, its military guarantor in the region. America's intervention in Iraq has completely failed to bring Iraqi oil production onto the market. And in fact, I think you've said in previous episodes that it's now Chinese companies who are involved in Iraq. And this issue in Yemen, where, again, it's the Americans getting involved and it's the Chinese that are benefiting. It just seems that there's something completely imbalanced in the geopolitics of the world, where America is still playing the role that we understand it to play, whether that's in Europe, the defense of Europe, the defense of Asia, or Taiwan in particular against the Chinese, in the Middle East in relation to Israel, as we've seen, and imposing some kind of order there, and now in South America with the Monroe Doctrine. All of them, we kind of expect America to continue playing that exact same role. And then when you try to appreciate the scale of those commitments to impose order everywhere, and then you see its ability to impose order is actually seems to be diminishing. That actually suggests a much more chaotic world to come, rather than a more ordered world to come.
Yeah, there's so much in what you just said, Tom. I think that a couple of things I would draw out. The first of them is the way in which the American border with Mexico fits into this story too. Mm-hmm. We talked about in earlier this year the impact that it's had on, or that political question has had on, American democratic politics really for quite some time now, and will clearly continue to have through this election year. And Venezuela is really, really part of that story, because the depth of the humanitarian crisis in Venezuela after 2014 has meant that something like 8 million people have left the country. And even if they've not in the first instance always gone to the United States, significantly more, say, gone to Colombia, they are still people who then may well be moving over the American border.
Yeah.
And so that the United States has got, in that sense, any administration in Washington has got considerable interest in trying to stabilize the economic situation in Venezuela, to try to deal with the border issue.
Yeah, Trump's making a big deal out of it now, isn't he? Yeah. To say a similar language to he used in the first election, but about Venezuela sending its gangs up into the United States.
Oh, he's very much trying to look, sort of say, I was tough with Venezuela, Biden's soft with it, and look what's happening. I mean, entirely ignoring the fact that actually he was trying to do a deal with Maduro most of 2020. And then there's another aspect to it which we haven't quite touched on yet, which is the Venezuela-Iran relationship. And this has been ongoing for a while. So Chavez, through the first decade of this century, was very keen on developing, cultivating relations with Iran. At one point he called the Venezuelan-Iranian relationship an axis of unity against US imperialism. Even Obama sanctioned the Venezuelan oil company back in 2011 over its dealings with Iran. And as Venezuela's economic situation deteriorated, including its ability to get or try to get around these sanctions, then the state that most helped it, particularly 2020, was Iran. 2022, Iran and Venezuela signed a 20-year cooperation agreement. Iranian ships regularly dock in Venezuela. So if that 2018 moment from Trump of maximum pressure, try and bring about regime change in Iran and try and bring about regime change in Venezuela, hasn't worked, which it clearly hasn't. Yeah. It's not just that they haven't worked individually.
They've brought them together.
They've brought them closer together.
And how does China play into this? Because again, China always just seems to loom in our stories, just sort of in the background, not paying any of the prices that other countries seem to pay in terms of the sanctions regimes or wars or that kind of thing, but just seems to kind of quietly get stronger. You know, its ships moving around the world, it being just as dependent on oil as any other country. I mean, is China involved in this story?
Very much so. I think one of the effects of the sanctions, whether they be on Iran, whether they be on Russia, or whether they be on Venezuela, is that China ends up then being the customer, perhaps even the principal customer, for those sanction regimes.
And knockdown prices.
Oil. Sometimes, I mean, less so now than was the case with the knockdown prices from Russia, but certainly for a while, very much so, knockdown prices. And the Chinese have been also cultivating their relations with the Venezuelan regime, helping them with the getting around the sanctions. And I think that what's really notable here is the fact that China's commercial presence, if you want to call it that, like in Venezuela, has got something else that runs in parallel with it that I think is going under the radar, and that is China's presence in the Panama Canal. So there are five ports, in the principal ports anyway, in the Panama Canal, and two of them are effectively Chinese owned. Now, one on the Atlantic side and one on the Pacific side, and that Panama itself has moved closer to China in recent years. So in 2017, it switched its diplomatic recognition from Taiwan to China. Panama joined Belt and Road in 2018. Hawaii has got a strong presence in Panama, including around the canal. And the Iranians have been determined to show that their naval ships might pass through the Panama Canal. Now, whether they have or whether they haven't is a little bit more complicated question, but they've been very assertive in their rhetoric about that. Now, if you think about this moment then, in that context of the long history we were talking about in the first half, the 1890s, the Americans are saying, actually, we're in charge of the Western Hemisphere. And that is a message to the European imperial powers as they see it. Like, you're gone now, stay out.
Yeah.
And in the taking Cuba in 1898, you might say that's the end of that European imperial story. This isn't European imperialism, but these are the revisionist powers in the world. And if we just threw Russia in, Russia has definitely provided some military weapons to Venezuela, who are trying to operate in what, from Washington's point of view, is still its backyard. And crucially, the transit through the Panama Canal.
Yeah, because I was going to say, there's one thing getting the oil out of the ground or, you know, offshore, onshore, whatever. Then you have to then, get it elsewhere. You have to export it. And that seems to be going through these pinch point places in the world that we've discussed a few times. And I do think the great irony of this is Venezuela is the anti-imperialist power of South America, who appeals to America to help it in its fight against the imperialist Britain, and then is fighting the imperialist America after that in order that it can get its hands on the good oil that is over the border in Guyana so it can export it to China. You know, this seems to be the world that we've emerged into. But where has the Monroe Doctrine gone then? If you've got China trying to assert at least some control over the Panama Canal, clearly in the Americas, and has managed to do so, and then you have obviously Venezuela that we've discussed and Brazil coming into OPEC Plus, this is actually a shifting balance of power in the Western Hemisphere, not just in East Asia or in Europe or in the Middle East. Again, you can see the plates starting to shift, and I come back to the point, but I do wonder whether in a world in which America is still extraordinarily powerful, and I've made this point before, its economy is growing very strongly, it has incredibly strong technology sector, military, all of that, but relative to other powers, China in particular, it's not as strong as it once was. I came across this fact over the weekend that Britain's economy was worth more than China and India combined in 1997. Obviously, now that's not the case. That's a very short period of time. 1997 doesn't feel very long ago. Think the difference between the United States and China. By some metrics, I think on purchasing power parity, the Chinese economy is now bigger than the American economy. These things matter in terms of your ability to project global power. And the Chinese are not trying to project their power anywhere near as expansively as the United States, as we've set out in this podcast. And you could see that sort of washing up onto American domestic politics itself. If they start to decide that they have to make choices about where they exert their power, it would seem to me quite obvious in a way that you could see the argument for saying that we have to start reasserting it in the Americas, in our backyard, more than we assert it elsewhere if we are forced to choose. Just because if we have a humanitarian collapse in Venezuela, as we saw, it washes up directly on our border in a way, while we're seeking to project our power all over the world but don't seem to be able to do so.
Yeah, I think one of the things that's really interesting here, and I'm not quite sure yet at least how to think about it, is the relationship between US power and predicaments in the Western Hemisphere and in East Asia. Because if we just go back to that 1898 moment, so coming 3 years after the assertion with some meaning of the Monroe Doctrine in relation to the Venezuela-British dispute, about Guyana. As we've said, that links pretty directly to the story of the Americans in the Pacific that we spent an episode at the beginning of the year talking about, the relationship between the Spanish-American War in 1898 and then the projection taking of the Philippines as an American colony, and the way in which what's happening over China and Taiwan interacts with that story. So in that sense, you could say that the Western Hemisphere issues are directly connected to the Pacific issues, the Western Pacific issues. What they're not directly connected to is Europe. That's, I think, the point that's coming out from the way in which we've been discussing, not just what we've been discussing today, but what we've really been discussing since the beginning of this.
Hence all the arguments about, you know, if somewhere is going to have to pay, it's going to have to be American influence in Europe, and Europe is going to have to start stepping up, and that's going to have all sorts of implications for the whole of Europe, obviously Ukraine in particular, but it's going to have dramatic implications for Britain as
even though we actually are talking a few maybe what 48 hours after the House of Representatives has finally agreed to send more military aid.
Yeah, it's agreed to spend about half the NHS budget for an entire year over to Ukraine. This is a big commitment that is being made. And so the question is, you know, that is being asked in Washington, can they continue to make these commitments everywhere? Which I think is the basically one of, if not the great question of 21st century geopolitics. So I suppose on that note, we should bring the episode to a close. Thanks ever so much for listening. We're going to try and delve into these questions of American power over the coming weeks. So please do tune in, like and follow and all of that, and see you next time.
And as ever, this podcast was produced by Ewan Daughtry.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.